Hunted by the Kraken, the sinister leader of the Rule Empire, Beverly Jordan must control her powers, known only as the Priori, to survive. Believing her powers fit only for destruction and ruin, Beverly and her brother Charlie set off on a journey to find the fabled haven of Kriana, an underwater world where one can learn to split the fabric of time and manipulate the lines of power, where winged alequines soar through the air, and the shadows lurk in waiting for someone to release them. Will Beverly escape the grasping clutches of the Kraken? Or is she destined to become his weapon? Chapter 16. Experiments. Dust wafted around Tamika like a fine mist, tickling the delicate hairs of her nostrils. Her eyes streamed with the effort of holding back a sneeze. Not daring to use the lines of power with the Sholak so close, she stood still, in the hope she would not stir any more dust in the tiny broom cupboard where she hid. The door fitted ill in its frame, leaving a gap between it and the door jamb, just wide enough for Tamika to make out the people in the other room. She knew it to be one open room, lit by the mottled light from the clearing through the windows and the hearth fire on the opposite wall. A large bed with threadbare rugs was pushed against the wall next to the door. A curtained washroom was pressed against the cupboard, and a large wooden table and chairs filled the remaining space. Tamika hoped her hostess had been prudent enough to remove Tamika's mug from its sanded surface and throw it amongst the washing up. The woman's voice had sounded shrill as she called for her son. She would have denied the existence of children if given the chance, but the soldiers had stepped over the wooden toys just as Tamika had an hour before. At least she knew better than to lie about the obvious. Tamika had seen what strike regiments did to people in secluded places like this, who had lied to the rule in their desperation. She could almost imagine the rank smell of the three soldiers filling her nose just as they filled her vision. She shifted a little to the left and saw the burly woodcutter and his plump wife, huddled in the ring of his arms. In a chair between them and the soldiers sat a young boy. Freckled face, set under a nest of blonde hair, he fidgeted as the soldiers slipped dull metal rings around his wrists and neck. Wires snaked from the oxidized bands to a box the size of a man's chest with several dials. The Sholak, smaller than the last time Tamika had seen one. She ground her teeth in frustration. The agents tried to find as many magic children as possible before the rule, but they couldn't save everyone. Clearly, more children than they knew had undergone rule experimentation to improve the device. Digging her nails into her hands, she held her breath. Maybe it wouldn't work this time. Maybe the kid had enough control. Maybe she wouldn't have to find out what other improvements the rule had provided the soldiers. A bare-armed soldier rotated the dial, his hawk-like face trained on the wristbands. The metal flickered, then glowed red like stirred embers, and a harsh whine filled the air, just loud enough to be uncomfortable to the ear. It was not the sparking, alarm-filled hysteria the Sholak gave for magic users in their full power, but it was enough to warn the soldiers. The Sholak controller slammed the dial to zero and flicked a switch. An orange light on the Sholak glowed, and the bands around the boy's wrists slammed together and fused, before leaping, to the boy's astonishment, to his neck to fuse with the metal there. Looking at the bands now, it was hard to believe they were originally large enough to be slipped over his hands and head, for they cupped his neck and wrists intimately. One of the soldiers, a lank-haired giant, stepped around the back of the boy's chair and leveled a spear at the couple. The woman's trembling voice ventured,
What does that mean?
A pock-faced, bulbous-nosed soldier hoisted the Shorlock in his arms.
"He belongs to the Kraken now."
"What?"
the woodcutter breathed. The boy cried out as the hawk-faced soldier swooped in and threw him over his shoulder.
"Mama! Papa!
What are you looking for? What does this mean? He's just a boy! No!"
shrieked the woman.
"Yowen!"
Her husband's muscles bulged against his skin as he held onto her, struggling for all she was worth, though the soldier's spear was only a handspan from her chest. "This has gone on long enough," thought Tamika. The strike regiment had their backs to her, which would make it easier. Keeping an eye on the unfolding scene, she wove a tight mesh of lines 2 feet square. She pushed it through the door and toward the soldiers, the mesh expanding the closer it came to them. The idea was to have the mesh inflate to the height of the tallest soldier, and then encompass all three in a net of lines, unable to move and easily herded to the intelligence circle's holding camp. The net was within 10 feet of the soldiers. 5 feet. 3 feet. The barrier hit the back of the spear-wielding soldier and dissolved. Tamika's legs went weak, and she scrambled at the wall to stop herself from falling. She felt drained of both power and confidence. What had happened? Unable to stop herself, she fell heavily against the cupboard door and went sprawling into the room beyond. She looked up, half expecting to see a spear point. Instead, she saw the winking orange light on the Shorlock disappear out the front door with the last soldier. Of course! The Shorlock was protecting the regiment from magic as it hauled away its latest victim. What hope did she have now that her powers were no use? When her powers unraveled with the touch of their skin? Just as quickly as despair tugged at her heart, an idea banished it, flooding her limbs with newfound energy. She stood, half lurching, half staggering, and barreled her way between the woodcutter and his wife, who crowded the doorway.
"I can save him,"
she cried, jerking out of the woodcutter's reflective grasp. Only one soldier, the lank-haired giant, was in the saddle. The other two were tying the boy, Eoin, and the Shorlock to a spare horse. In a moment or two, they would all be mounted and gone, and Tamika would lose the best chance she had of rescuing the boy. 3 thick branches clustered together on a tree to her left. They looked heavy enough for her purpose, taking a line of power parallel to the tree's trunk. Tamika directed the line to stretch until it was razor thin, and then sliced the branches off at their base. She selected 4 of the lines passing through the top branch in one hand, and, like a puppeteer, she used the lines to haul the branch through the air. Aiming for the easiest target, the branch caught the mounted soldier in the stomach and launched him from the saddle. Pressing him against the trunk of the closest tree, the branch holding him captive. Tamika let out a grunt of satisfaction and tied the lines in her hands to her belt. The Shorlock may stop direct magic on the soldiers, but it couldn't stop her from magicking the surrounds. The bulbous-nosed soldier met the same fate, his spooked horse leaving him open to Tamika's flying second branch. Her third branch froze in mid-air as she realized she had gone for the wrong soldier first. The hawk-faced soldier was attempting to wrestle the struggling Eowyn from his horse. In his left hand he held a jagged knife, which had already scored the boy's leg 6 times. Only the dancing animal beneath the child stopped the soldier from getting a proper hold on him. Yet the rule was too close to Eowyn for Tamika to use her final weapon. As she cast about for something, anything, to rope the soldier back, she heard Eowyn scream. Blood gushed from a deep cut in his calf. More reflective than planned, the boy's foot lashed out and connected with the soldier's head, sending him sprawling to the ground. That gave Tamika all the room she needed. The soldier had barely gotten to his knees before the final branch swept him away. Unable to move to Eowyn's aid, for she was literally tied to her spells, she pulled a bandage soaked in healing magic from her belt purse and threw it at the woodcutter, who was rushing to the aid of his son. It would heal even the deepest cuts within minutes.
"Use this! Bind it tight!"
she bellowed, before turning to the problem that faced her. Maintaining the three spells was draining, and the Sholak was wearing away her magic on the branches, proving that even an indirect touch of magic could not hold them captive forever. She could not stomach killing them in cold blood, and if she knocked them out, it was just as good as a death sentence, if the murderous look on the woodcutter's eyes was any indication. There was only one way forward. The canopy of leaves rustled above, encouraging, inviting. Tamika cleared her mind, shrugging her bare feet from her shoes and digging them into the moist grass and earth. Closer to the roots, closer to the heart of the three trees she wished to change. Tapping into the magic of the trees, she made the fibers and atoms of wood vibrate. The soldiers cried out as the rough bark at their backs destabilized and turned to liquid. They sank under the pressure of the three branches, first torso, then flailing limbs enveloped until the final soldier's sneering face and shouted curses were swallowed up. Releasing her magic slowly, the bark became solid once more, and Tamika collapsed to her knees on the soft earth. Each of the three trunks bulged out at the point where the soldier was absorbed into its heart. Over time, the tree's steady and calm thoughts would impact the soldiers until they are the same and man became tree. A gentle hand brushed wayward strands of hair from Tamika's face and offered a cup of clear water. She drank greedily. The woodcutter's wife crouched next to her, watchful.
"You're not really a traveling storyteller, are you?"
Tamika shook her head.
"You're not frightened of me?"
"You saved my son."
"The Sholak detects magic. Your son has magic."
"Magic doesn't..."
The woman bit her lip, cutting herself off. Though tired beyond belief, Tamika forced her words to be gentle rather than blunt.
"You saw what I did."
The woman nodded.
"Now, can you truly tell me magic doesn't exist?"
"No,"
she whispered.
"The Kraken will experiment on your son if he finds him. He's not safe here. If one strike regiment can find you, more will come."
Her eyes welled up.
"What can we do?"
"I can take him to a place where others like us are safe from the Kraken."
"That's why you came. To rescue Eowyn before the Rule could take him away."
"Yes."
Hope filled her face. This was always the hardest part.
"But I can't take you with him,"
said Tamika. The woman stood abruptly and turned her back. Tamika sighed and hauled herself to her feet. She put a hand on the woman's shoulder.
"Better safe than dead."
"I couldn't bear it if he was dead."
"If it would make it easier, I could remove your memories of him, so..."
"No."
She spun and clutched Tamika's arms.
He is better safe than dead, but I refuse to forget him. But please, let us spend just a few more days with him before he goes."
The refusal she had prepared died on her lips at the woman's intensity. Her shaking hands rattled Tamika's frame, and her wide brown eyes pleaded. She continued.
"You saved him, so I trust you. Please grant me this last wish."
Against her better judgment, Tamika replied.
"All right. I'll return for him in 5 days.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to Chapter 16, and this is Episode 21. Welcome.
Hooray!
Yay! It's our final episode for the year! Hooray!
Wow.
And I just realized this is probably going to come out after Christmas as well, so...
Yeah, right.
Soz for all the Christmas references, everyone.
You've already suffered through it, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So I have here on the podcast with me Colin Smith, Kevin Powell, Lois Spangler, and David, the intern of Awesome.
Hello.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
So, guys, this one, another short chapter.
Yeah. Where did the episode go? Again.
Hey.
With the mini chapters.
Wait, has it started?
Yeah. You make the same joke every time, and I'm pretty sure that the podcast listeners they've got it.
Consistency.
That's right.
Well, someone could be just tuning in at this episode, and they haven't gotten the jokes before.
Well, if so, this is a nice one to tune in on. It's kind of its own self-contained little chapter. What did you guys think? Not all of our usual suspects in this one.
Yeah, right.
This Tamika is a badass.
Yeah.
For sure. Yes, definitely. I like her a lot.
But the reason why I actually put this in was because I wanted to show what the current state of the world was now.
Oh,
so
for
whether
sure.
you know whether people you know whether they were continuing to test people, why were they continuing to test people? You know, considering the fact that the Sholak is supposed to find the host, I just wanted to explore what the consequences were if you were born after the Kraken's weapon.
Yeah.
And you happened to have some sort of magic.
Mm. Yeah, because we've seen Beverly and Charlie evade it. But this is a good thing to see what happens if you don't.
Yeah.
And to see that the focus isn't just on the one person who's bearing the priori, that there are other people who are just as not as valuable, but certainly targets.
Mm-hmm. And Tamika sort of reveals a little bit extra knowledge that they actually go up and rescue people, and that they know that there are still people born with magic, and they know that the rule have been using them to experiment and improve the Sholak.
The Sholak actually is kind of its own character, and I feel like it's even he feels even more evil than the Kraken in a lot of ways, because it's an unfeeling machine, but it also kind of exudes this kind of malice, which
there's a terrible nihilism to that circle, because the Sholak's being improved by essentially feeding like into like a wood chipper people who are magical.
Yeah.
They are essentially being destroyed to improve the Sholak. And then at the end of all of this, if somehow the Sholak manages to weed out all magic again, simply by just, I don't know, if in your world, by devouring it, or if in the world you've set up and there's like a genetic predisposition towards it, so the more people who are magical that get wiped out, maybe it doesn't come back. But then the Sholak basically is left as being this incredibly refined device that has no purpose.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it had me in mind that I thought maybe they haven't quite identified who has the priori. You know, maybe it's guesswork, or they're not quite convinced that Beverly's got it, so they're going to keep on testing anyway, you know, covering their asses perhaps. I don't know, that's what hit me.
And the Kraken can't assume that all of it was in one hit. He can't assume that it didn't split somehow, you know. So you can understand him covering his bases. But you can also think that, well, maybe he's continuing to improve the Sholak because he wants to use that in the hunt for Beverly.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, the more refined the Sholak is, once he gets his hands on her, the faster he can remove her as a threat.
Yeah,
for sure.
And also, you've already put down the down payment on that Sholak, so you might as well be using it.
God damn it. It's not through its warranty period yet.
Yeah. The Kraken's sitting at home on the couch, and the Sholak's just sort of on the floor, and he's like, I did order that through the catalog. I should probably use it.
It's just going to gather dust.
You could try and sell it again on Sprite Tree, but you never know how that's going to go.
You know, I'm sick of it getting set off every time I walk past it.
In the first scene, you see Beverly reach out to the soldiers, and they've kind of got a bit of a mind shield going on, and that's because of the Sholak.
Mm.
But now it's gotten to the point where the Sholak protects the soldiers from direct magic. Not just, like, you know, shields them from mental manipulation. It literally nullifies.
Is that due to the Kraken having used it for so long that it's getting more power, or is he putting more stuff into it?
Well, if you think about it, what happens is the Sholak acts as a detector. So this is micro pseudoscience lesson here. Anything, yeah. if you're going to detect something, you have to pass some sort of current or signal or something through the Sholak. So depending on how strong the magic is, you're going to have to pass some of the magic through Sholak, which means the Sholak has to be insulated. Yeah. In some form. Uh-huh. And so the insulation that's built in. Exactly. It's like a grounding in sure. essence. And so the insulation has just gotten better. So that made me sound like I'd really thought through that, but I only thought through that just then.
Okay. It was probably floating around in your head in an instinctive level, you know.
Yes, but I am a writer, so bullshit artist over here. Yeah. But the interesting thing I liked was how Tamika then went about getting around that.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
I love the way you write action there. It was really gripping the way that came out, you know.
Who'd like an action scene?
Yeah. It's really cool.
So how did you guys feel about the soldiers being absorbed into trees?
It's genius.
Not necessarily killing them, but at the same time.
Well, like, the fact that they aren't killed is probably what makes it more horrific.
Yeah. Well, at least that's like, killing them.
You take the edge off a little bit by being like, oh, the trees are kind of going to reprogram these guys to be less, like, jerks.
Yeah.
Is that better? I don't know. Having her personality changed as well as not dying.
She's very practical, isn't she, Tamika? Like, at the end, she opts to wipe the memories from the mother if she would like. That's a very, it's not the nicest response, but it's very pragmatic and, you know.
Yeah. And you can see that it eats at her, that she's been in this situation before almost, and she's like, oh, well, I could do this, but I understand if you don't want it.
Tamika's kick-ass, but, I she's very pragmatic, and she's like, all right, no killing, but brain absorption slash, memory removal, means to an end.
Yeah. Yeah. You're a witness. You saw this. How are you dealing with it? Can you live with it? No? Okay, great. We've got a fix for that.
Yeah.
But she does have that emotion at the end where she's like, okay, I'll give you your, even though she knows that it's probably not the best idea, I'll give you your days and then I'll come back and get him.
Right.
Because she's not a monster.
No. But at the same time, at the same time, it's maximizing the amount of time she's above.
Oh, yeah.
On the surface, which is as dangerous for her as it is for the boy.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Mm. What if she doesn't come back?
For him?
Yeah. And the mother's like, ah, actually, I've done everything I want to do with this kid. And
parenting fail.
I guess I'll just call up the Kraken or something.
kid, you're 16. Go get a job or something. Just get out of my hair.
Yeah.
Speaking of the Kraken, we have an amazing Kraken Goodreads.
We do.
Oh, baby. It's so good. And look, Kevin has volunteered to do the theme song today.
You didn't see the rabbit ears around the word volunteer, did you? Damn these podcasts.
All right, so Kevin, please, delight us.
It's beginning to sound a lot like Kraken. Reading everything. From the spam upon your site to the letter you wrote just right, but here's a special Christmas treat.
Wonderful.
I love it.
Yay!
I think that wins.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, this one is a poem that our very own Sam wrote.
Yay, Sam! Did he write it to a particular Christmas song poem thing?
No, to a poem, yes. And I'll leave it to the listeners to work it out, because it's pretty damn easy.
'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the rule, the Sholak were testing, painful and cruel. In Kriana they huddle, under the sea, hoping this peace continues to be. The children were hidden away in the dark, with visions of torture recent and stark. But they have escaped the Kraken's first trap, so it seems like time to have a recap. Charlie and Bev had fled in the night, but then quickly failed to stay out of sight. Power was called, death was its answer. They escaped the grasp of the dire necromancer. Satine was confident she had a great plan. Well, part of one. The escape didn't scan. With Cypress in tow, they knew where to look, and straight to Beverly, a beeline they took. They meet up with Elliot, such a trustworthy fellow. Now to find nails and whales that bellow. The riddle is solved, Kriana's right there, though Elliot's missing, which gives them a scare. But no time for that, there's learning to do. Books and classes and amulets too. Mythical creatures, new friends, new foes, a pair of mad sphinxes with sharp stony toes. Exciting tournaments, Alequine's soaring. Charlie is wistful, but at least it's not boring. So are they now safe? Can they now rest? Oh, my dear reader, surely you jest. The Kraken is waiting for just the right time. He's patient and cunning, his plans quite sublime. As his knowledge expands beyond mortal ken, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. So good, because he's like, he's done it up until almost what we've been doing, so like, so no spoilers.
It fits in really well as well. It fits in with this episode as well, because it's about the Sholak at the start and everything.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
I know, I didn't even realize when, yeah, it was awesome. So good, Sam, we love you so much.
This guy is wasted in all the jobs that he does. He should be poet laureate to, like, the queen or something.
I'll tell you right now, my coworkers will murder you if you try to take him away from our office right now.
My favorite, I have to say I'm quite partial to the Sphinx's line with their pointy toes.
Yeah.
Great.
Satinay's fairly poor escape plan.
See, this is why I want to do the Sphinx's read as well, because I think they're excellent characters.
Yeah. The thing that I love about that little poem as well is it is such a perfect recap. It's like my synopsis in like 150 words.
Yeah. And I feel like it's better than most recaps you ever see, especially like most poetic.
I should submit that to publishers. I have to say, Cole, that's going to be one of my favorite Kraken Goodreads.
It's
that was
one of my favorites too.
Read
yeah.
with
yeah,
such too. Menace.
Thank you.
Such menace.
I try.
We started doing the 12 Days of Christmas. And now we are going to finish the 12 Days.
Finish it.
On the sixth day of Christmas, my true love said to me, what does it all mean? I mean, what is it all about? Does anything have any meaning anymore? What's going on? I need more eggnog. I love you.
That
so, guys, what
that
does it all mean?
Quickly.
What does it all mean? Terrifying.
Right.
It means that maybe we've had a bit too much eggnog.
I think
maybe,
between each sentence there was a bit of eggnog with rum in it.
Maybe an IV of eggnog.
How even is eggnog?
How old?
How alcoholic is it?
I used to make eggnog without any alcohol in it.
I think the mildly alcoholic eggnog's referred to as Mummy's Little Helper at Christmas time.
Oh. What do you
they
mean?
They sell it at the supermarket. It's not bad for my child.
Yeah, exactly.
Bottom shelf. You know what that means?
Bottom shelf has probably got minions on it.
Yeah,
yeah, that's all they need to sell it to children. They just put a picture of
it. Just giving them the idea. Yeah. They're going to do it.
Or it's got Star Wars on it or something.
It's true, isn't it, Kevin? Come on. Come on, you can confess.
Yeah, you're the dad.
What am I confessing? Oh, no, look, our kid isn't old enough yet to actually engage meaningfully with advertising, although we're going to start... We're buying her a Hey Dougie doll this year, so that'll be the first of it, because that's the only brand she recognizes, and it's just characters.
You have fallen into the trap. She knows exactly what's going on. She's just fooling you.
Yeah. You know, so
she's been drinking the eggnog, making plans.
Yeah. She's got over you already. You know,
Kevin walks in sometime, and she's in a wingback chair with a brandy snifter filled with eggnog, just like... I've been expecting your father.
And a candy cigar.
So yeah. Kevin, you know how you had that cream to numb her gums when her teeth come through?
Oh yeah,
really? You've been prescribed eggnog.
No!
Dropping a little bit of eggnog in there. Yeah,
but that's impossible.
On the fifth day of Christmas, my true love said to me, "Is Santa using the same loophole in our slavery laws as Willy Wanks?" Which was then autocorrected to Willy Wanker? Then autocorrected to God damn it, Willy Wonka.
Willy Wanks, that's who it is, isn't it? It's Willy Wanks?
No,
that's
the one. Willy Wanker. Willy Wanker.
That's of Harry course. Yeah, right.
So, is Santa using the same loophole in our slavery laws as Willy Wanks? and his Oompa Loompa.
Doompity doo. We have got a question for you.
Is that how they talk as well? We have got a question for you.
I don't think they talk. I think they're just incomplete. They're in musical land.
I believe they glower is what they do.
Yeah.
Silently. And then when they need to talk, they'll sing about it. Because that's the way it works.
Terrifying tiny Jersey Shore dwarves.
Yeah.
Oh, mercy.
So I reckon Santa totally uses the same loophole. I mean, elves, surely they come from another, maybe not the Oompa Loompa world, but, you know, they've been brought in from somewhere else.
Yeah, we call it that.
You know, whether it's alternate planet or alternate universe. Maybe they're like rejected Vulcans because, you know, they're stumpy. And so maybe, like, you know, because the Vulcans are really elitist. So maybe they send their little ones out into space and then Santa collects them and then uses the same loophole in the slavery laws as Willy Wanker.
All right, so we have the text of Willy Wonka, and it says in there what he does and why they work for him and what the loophole is that he's using, and it's basically that they they owe him a life debt, basically. I think
it's like Han Solo and Chewie.
It's a Wookiee life debt. He's just, when you shave down a Wookiee enough, it's a little orange man with green hair. So there's that. From the mythology of the Christmas story, the story of Santa Claus, it is way too murky to really say stuff like that. But some things say that he's a supernatural creature himself, and there's a whole other lot of laws that require.
Maybe he himself is under slavery. Maybe someone has caught him into a loophole in our world and is like, "Bitch, you're gonna make toys for kids."
Oh man!
Oh, so it's like under a gas.
There's a
boss of bosses that we haven't even seen yet. Unseen. Santa boss.
Santa.
Oh, if it's Saint Nicholas, then it'd be God, I guess, or Jesus. So maybe there's a Han Solo Chewie thing happening there, where Jesus saved Saint Nicholas some Russian king's life.
Are you going all C.S. Lewis on us?
Or it could be the Coca-Cola Corporation.
Podcast
is not endorsed by the Coca-Cola Corporation or any of its subsidiaries. Any opinions expressed during this podcast are not the opinions of Coca-Cola.
I'm in love with the Vulcan thing. Oh no.
It's okay, Kevin. You can talk about it.
Do it.
I was just gonna say, I love the idea of every year, like, standing, sitting in down and going, oh, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
All right. So, fourth day of Christmas. Cole.
Oh, that wasn't me.
Totally it was you.
No, it was Kevin.
It was Kevin.
Yeah.
On the fourth day of Christmas, my true love said to me, am I secretly a racial supremacist if I'm dreaming of a white Christmas? I mean, am I some kind of neo-Nazi super spy sleeper agent?
Either that or you're into, like, nuclear doom.
You're dreaming of a nuclear Christmas.
Well, you're also being North Hemispherist.
Yes. Although, if you live in Tasmania, it's give or take right now.
Oh my God! Yeah. I was in Cradle Mountain when it was snowing. It was my first time in the snow, and my jaw was on the pavement. I loved it. So
it snowed in November.
In November, it was ridiculous. Yeah.
Colin was there.
Cradle Mountain's weird.
Snow angels drinking eggnog.
It was the best. But yeah, they're still getting snow. Like, what was it, a few days ago? Another part of Tassie was getting snow. Yeah, so, you know, how many snowbound countries are there in the Southern Hemisphere? Not many.
Too much the Antarctic.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Yeah. Does that mean that if white equates to Christmas, then it is always Christmas in Antarctica?
Or is it black Christmas down here?
Yeah. Black Christmas is the name of my Black Sabbath Christmas
Man, Christmas
cover band.
The Yuletide of Blood is coming.
I think what you're shooting for with this question is, really, I want a more diverse Christmas, which is a good thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
the fact that you're questioning it means you're on the right path.
Yeah.
I think it probably, if anything, it means you're not a sleeper agent.
That's true.
Yeah. If you're asking the question.
Speaking of Nazis right now, Facebook is suggesting the English Defense League page to me.
Where does that come from for you?
I don't know.
Wait, like the English language or the English?
No, the English Defense League is in, like.
Because I immediately was like, oh, well, it's obviously grammar Nazis or something getting in contact.
Gotta use Oxford commas, motherfuckers. Otherwise, we're just not sure what you're talking about.
I think we should make grammar sleeper spy agents. Where, you know, all of a sudden they come out and they've got their, like, ninja nunchucks, which are just giant red pens, and they just draw all over people's faces.
Yeah.
I feel like
and they correct people's text messages en route.
It's not what you spelled there.
Anyway.
So, Lois.
Yeah. God, I hate singing. You know, I have absolutely no problem making a fool of myself on stage with jokes that I've written. God help me if I have to pretend to sing. All right, now, I'm going to try an accent here, and I suspect it's going to fall apart at the end, but I don't care, because it fits the line.
Yes.
On the third day of Christmas, my true love said to me, who's are these? I said, who's the fuck are these? Because you know what? These sure as fuck are not mine.
Fine. That was totally fine.
That was brilliant. So I know the question was, whose are these? But what I want to ask you is, hey, what did she find?
Does it make a difference? They're not mine.
Yeah, I'm already running. Not my fault. Okay.
Maybe like a little Santa cock sock or like...
just hanging by the fireplace.
In a different place.
Oh, I thought it was a stocking. What else could they be? Candy canes?
You know what? It could be. It could be Christmas. It could be fruitcakes, because fruitcakes in the United States are mostly biological warfare between families.
Really? What is that? Because you just can't get a good fruitcake in the U.S.?
Yeah. I have had good fruitcakes, and it's sort of a stereotypical thing. It's like saying, "Man, they're so weird." Let me tell you, it's another dumb stereotyped joke.
Oh, yeah.
To say that, oh, fruitcakes are totally inedible. But if you compare most American fruitcakes to the kind of Christmas cakes and puddings you get here, yes, they are inedible.
My nana used to put 5-cent pieces in the fruitcakes that she made.
No, I still have cakes like that. Like, yeah.
I'm just wondering what sort of underwear, like, Mrs. Claus would wear.
That's random.
So that's, like, the immediate, like, who the fucks are these? Like,
oh my God. So right. You are so right.
Right?
Okay. Sorry, I even questioned you, yes.
We've never been in that situation, Emily, so we were completely naive to what that could even be pertaining to.
So, yeah, Mrs. Claus is going to get up in Santa's shit because there's undies under the bed.
Maybe it could be, like, really innocent. Maybe it's the morning of, it's the kids that have come downstairs and no one's put any, like, labels on any of the presents. So you don't know who's presents were. Yeah, exactly.
Just someone with a bit of a...
I didn't buy any of these.
Yep. Yeah. With the family stress, it's just one more question on your plate.
You don't want that answer. This is brand new wrapping paper. I use the stuff from last year. I don't know.
I read mine in newspaper.
All right. This poor old Santa has actually come down the chimney and left actual presents.
Yeah.
well, who bought these? Come on. Go on. Was it you?
Or maybe.
Well, who's this? It might be a bomb.
Maybe Santa hasn't gotten with the times, and he's leaving stereotypical boy and girl presents, and he's, you know, he's leaving the wrong ones with the wrong people.
Good Lord.
I think he knows better, because that whole stereotypical boy and girl toy stuff didn't happen until the 60s and 70s when advertisers and marketers realized they could sell twice as many toys.
Yeah.
Did you see the sort of stuff that Winston Churchill was getting around in when he was a kid? Look it up. Yeah. It's amazing.
It's true. Yeah, and the boys were wearing beautiful little day dresses. They're gorgeous.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
So I realized that I haven't actually read out Sam's responses to these very things. So for the 6 days of Christmas where we're drinking far too much eggnog, Sam has gone, nothing. It's all meaningless. We're just meat suits made from star stuff hurtling blindly through the void on a hunk of rock. Then we die. Merry Christmas.
I think that's going to be, then we die.
Actually, yeah, I kind of like Emily's read of that. That's not how I imagined it, but it's actually pretty beautiful.
So for day number five, when he's asking about slavery loopholes with Willy Wonka, he says, yes, obviously. And then on the fourth day of Christmas, with our racial supremacist white Christmas, he says, aktivieren?
Yeah, which is German for activation.
There you go. Right. Aktivieren.
Not that I'm a Nazi.
Not that I know. Oh,
nice. No, then.
and then the third day of Christmas, where we've don't know what we found, but we know that they sure aren't ours. Sam has said, "This is awkward, but those are mine. How about we never talk about this ever?"
Perfect. Oh my God.
So, Colin.
Okay.
Take it away.
Sure. On the second day of Christmas, my true love said to me. Fuck! Holy shit, why are all these crows circling around the North Pole?
Guys, why are these crows circling around the North Pole?
Well, we all know Santa Claus is actually Odin, duh. Yeah.
it's just two crows.
It's just two, yeah. There's a couple of wolves there as well.
Does that mean the World Tree is at the North Pole as well?
Must be.
It must be. That actually fits pretty well.
Yeah. You know, you'd think, well, you know, Yggdrasil would wend its roots through the whole globe, you know. So.
Yeah.
And what's
and we know that. Yeah. We know that the Greek god Atlas is underneath the world at the South Pole, holding it up. So kind of the whole thing.
It's just science.
So I suppose that means that, like, Marvel have cleaned up Odin's potty mouth. Then, if that's what he's yelling.
Like, if you can get the director's cut of the comic and movies, it's the Ravens. It's the Ravens doing all of the swearing.
Totally don't go that way, you fucking idiot.
Yeah, yeah.
My dearly beloved son, Thor. Jesus, fuck you, are good sometimes.
All things considered, Thor could be Santa. I mean, like, he wouldn't need a sleigh or anything. He'd just need the hammer.
Yeah.
Just fly around with the hammer.
He's so much cooler than Santa.
Oh, is that
Odin is as well.
Sam's answer to this was, maybe this year we just buy presents ourselves and tell the kids Santa brought them.
Nice.
Okay, now the final day of Christmas gets to go to David, intern of Awesome, and I freely admit that I'm the only one on this podcast that does not understand this reference.
Oh,
so I'm assuming that I'm in for a treat.
It was written by Sam, wasn't it? It was written by Sam.
Yeah, Sam. Yeah.
On the first day of Christmas, my true love said to me, "Finungle milglunaf Cthulhu rahale."
I'm bleeding out my ears now.
What the fuck? I don't.
And it's really weird for me to be saying that because I'm from Innsmouth. We don't really deal with Cthulhu that much. It's mostly Dagon.
Well, yeah, you're fish people.
Yeah.
What?
So, to stop it from confusing you, that line that I dare not pronounce again, is a very famous bunch of gobbledygook from H.P. Lovecraft, who he made up his own little... I think he basically just wrote out random letters on his typewriter.
Yeah.
I think there was a bit of a method to it, but yeah, so it's this chant that the worshippers of Cthulhu, who you've heard of, surely?
Yes.
Yeah, so they use that, and it basically, I think loosely the meaning is something like in Relay, which is this underwater city.
Where he reigns, yes.
Yeah, it's somewhere off the coast of New Zealand, apparently. there's in the Pacific Ocean somewhere. And deep in Relay, Cthulhu waits sleeping, until the point that he wakes up, and then he's going to take us all into his arms. So the cultists just chant that, and it's crazy.
And so they do it every Christmas.
All the time.
Well, in its own way, it's a comment on religion and stuff like that. But they don't do it every Christmas. They do it when they gather, at the unnamed woods or at the at the Chapel Hill or wherever they want to gather.
Just patiently waiting for some. Like sick investigator to find them.
I think it's a good comment on beliefs and ritual in general, really. And that's what Christmas is. You know,
it is. It totally is.
Yeah.
Well, that explains Sam's very strong answered reaction, which was nope, 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 nah, no.
Yeah.
Thus ends the 12 days of Priori Christmas.
Yes.
They were definitely Priori-esque.
I did want to, because we're coming to the end of our chat.
For
2015. And I would like to hand over to Kevin, who is going to dedicate our podcast to someone he knows.
Thanks, guys. I just wanted to take a few moments just to say a few words because in amongst the string of stars being plucked from the sky recently, with talented icons being lost to us, people who have been so much a part of our life for so long, someone who's been known and dear to Colin and myself for quite some time, also sadly passed away recently, a lovely woman by the name of Karen Fanges. Karen was someone that I met, it would have been over 10 years ago, at a Brisbane role-playing convention. We sidled up to a room for a game that Karen was running, and very quickly realized that the premise of the game was to keep up with Karen's absurdist sense of humor and incredible wit and intelligence for 3 hours. And we left the room with sore cheeks and sore ribs from laughing so hard. It was an amazing time, and Karen very quickly became someone who was a welcome sight and a wonderful familiar face at role-playing conventions over the years. And personally, she became not just a dear friend, but also a collaborator as well. Now, that's just a small part of what Karen's passing means, because Karen was also a mother, a daughter, a wife, a teacher, and so many things to so many people. And as much as it sounds like a cliche, words do struggle to do justice to her passing. My heart particularly goes out to her husband Keith and daughter Jess, who are left to deal with the pain of her absence going forward. So Karen, Your memory will live on in the hearts and minds of everyone that you've touched.
Hmm. Nice, man. Yeah.
So?
Thank you so much. This
is dedication to her.
Yeah.
In memory of Karen Fanches.
I don't know if it's born, but it was experiment on. You said experiment with.
Excellent.
It's more of not a bit less buddy-buddy. Like,
yeah.
Me and the Kraken are going to go experimenting.
Yay! Let's build a Coke rocket.
Okay. I got a new arm.
It's a tentacle. I'm the Winter Soldier.
we could make it easier. No, I don't want easier.
I changed my mind.
No. That doesn't sound like it's going to end poorly at all.
No, that's going to go according to plan.
No, I'm done.
This is what the Sholak sounds like, everyone.
Sam does not like getting put halfway through things. I don't get it either. Enough.
You have my brain in your axe. Wait, no.
You were communicating by a wing buzz.
It was definitely an N-word. You got to take that bullet out of my arm.
Shod? Shed.
Shod.
Ed?
Shod?
Shed. Oh, sarcasm.
After losing Kevin once again to Robot Kevin.
Priori the Podcast is a full cast audio of the fantasy novel Priori, written by Emily Craven, the author of the Grand Adventures of Madeline Cain series. The podcast is produced by Emily Craven and Kevin Powell and contains the voiceover talents of Emily, Kevin, Sam Piaggio, Colin Smith, and Lois Spangler. Intro and outro music is thanks to composer Christopher Healy. Our audio intern is the amazing David Fithian. Each weekly episode contains a chapter of Priori, as well as a gag reel and chat with the cast. To find out more about Priori, Emily, the cast, or to sign up to the newsletter of Awesome, go to www.originalfantasy.com/Priori podcast. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please consider while you're at the website donating the price of a cup of coffee towards us paying our wonderful voiceover actors. These guys have freely donated their time for this project, and Emily would like to shower them with riches so they'll consider creating more podcasts with her and for you in the future.